Hey, Bobby Manning here. Welcome to Dome Theory NBA Finals Edition as the finals continue on Monday with a Game 5 that could see the Celtics become NBA champions. So, of course, we got to talk about it with Taylor McLeod, who going back to, 2017-ish, 2018, that range, you started doing post-game shows with us.
Yeah, so you were having me call in 2016, right when we first met. So I was calling in 16, but I started doing the show with you in 17.
Yeah, and it's, you know, we're going to do the whole thing here and talk about the path that got them here if they're going to win this championship. And it would take something historic and cataclysmic to prevent that from happening at this point. And it'd be very Celtics to scare us on the way to where they're going here in a big way and make it hard on themselves. So it might be fitting for them to win this in six games or something like that after going up 3-0. Man, if they won it in seven, that would probably be the scariest moment in recent Boston sports history. But it could happen in five. They're heavily favored to do it in five. And as we talk about it here, Taylor, we've both been watching this team for a long time. We've both been watching this team closely for about a decade now. And the coolest part of them finally getting this done, beyond the fact that 3 years ago it looked like it was not going to happen, is there's a straight line from them trading Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce, getting the picks that became Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, picking Marcus Smart the next year, forming that core, and right through today where they're going to do it around Brown and Tatum. And obviously it's a little bittersweet that they're going to do it without Smart. You know, some people are going to feel one way about that, some people are going to feel the other, but regardless, the fact that Brown, Tatum are going to do it here together. And the biggest thing for me on a personal level is seeing Al Horford do it again, a guy you thought might not be able to get it done here, after these last couple of years went after he left the Celtics in 2019. That to me is going to be the most gratifying thing, is watching him win it. But I know you is a big Brown Tatum guy, and you know Celtics fans everywhere love those guys. That's going to be the sweetest thing, is that those guys who so many questioned, who so many wanted to split up at a certain point, who so many doubted at different points, are going to get it done, and they're going to be the drivers of this.
Yeah, I mean, I remember you and I were talking in early 2021 season, so 21-22, the first final season. And it didn't look great at that moment. That was when they were really up and down. Ime was in his first and only year, but it was early. And I remember I just told you, I was like, I'm fine with this team. Like, I believe in this team as long as Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum are on the team. And I still feel like that. And now we're here, you know, one game away from them winning the NBA Finals. And I still feel like that, but I feel even better about it. And I felt better and better about it pretty much ever since the beginning of that 21-22 season. There's certain bittersweet parts of it, but you look around not just the NBA, but all sports. And a lot of the times, like, for teams to reach their peak, you have to make those hard decisions. And, you know, like losing Smart hurt in the moment, and it still stings, you know, to know that they're right on the doorstep without him. But you look at the return for him, and then the spot that he vacated that they then filled with Drew Holiday, right? So you get Porzingis for him, and then you fill that empty hole with Drew Holiday in it. It's unfortunate that it happened that way, but I ultimately, you know, I do think there's something to be said for those two coming in, especially Drew, as we've seen, you know, playing that same position, that I don't know if what they have accomplished to this point this year would have been possible as they were constructed for so many years.
I don't think so either. They had flaws. The leadership dynamic on the team had to change, and I think that was the goal in moving Smart, or one of the main reasons they moved Smart at that point, is to free up Brown and Tatum as leaders. And I wasn't sure they were ready to grasp it, but they did, and it's pretty impressive how they did it. Brown especially here, and that's where I want to go next as I mess with the things here. He's going to win Finals MVP, which is crazy. He just won East Finals MVP. Many question the extension, him becoming the highest paid player in NBA history. He had the meltdown of all meltdowns in game 7 last year and got clowned all summer for it. And he had a bumpy start to this year. And the conversation I remember having early this year on the postgame show is, where's he going to fit in here? Because you could have argued going into the year, he was like the fourth or fifth option based on how the team came together. And he was going to have to find his own spots to score. And there were some games where he got lost in the shuffle. And we've watched for years, he was a guy who would always go missing despite reaching those high highs. For him, in the dynamic of this team with so much talent around him, with Tatum being the point of attack guy so often, to find his role on the fly and excel at his role in a way that's going to reach him to this position. Cause you know, Tatum's obviously going to make the Hall of Fame, Taylor, just based on what he's doing right now. Going into this year, I don't think you would have said Brown was a slam dunk Hall of Famer. And this year, this performance, these MVP awards he's about to rack up here, they're going to make him a Hall of Fame lock today.
Yeah. First of all, I don't think it's so, and obviously you're much closer to the people who vote and how things actually work. So this could be just how I feel. I don't know if it's such a foregone conclusion that he's finals MVP. Like, it's not like his numbers are incredibly better than Tatum's, right? If Tatum has a monster closeout game, like, you don't think those voters are just going to, you don't think there's any chance the voters, you know, would vote for Tatum?
There's a chance. His opportunity was in game 4, and he really stunk it up there.
He wasn't worse than Brown. Brown was considerably worse in game 4.
Right, but Brown had done more to that point and had a little bit of a lead.
Had he, though?
Yeah, the 30 in game 3. Game 2, he had the big shot at the end of game 3, too.
30 in game 3, he got outscored in game 3.
Yeah. But he also had the big shot at the end. He's been the one at the point against Luka. You know, I think Tatum has a great case, but he's also just shot worse than
certainly. Brown. And we don't, point. You know, I'm obviously playing around a little bit with, because me and you have been doing that for. That's crazy to think about, that you and I have been having this like back and forth. Now, I wouldn't even call it an argument necessarily, but we were on like a couch recording this in your apartment building at Syracuse, being like, who's better? Who's going to be the guy? And now we're here. And it's like, well, you know, Tatum scored 31 in game 3 and Brown scored 30. And we're like, well, yeah.
And that's why it's so great for me that Brown's in pole position on this. Who would have ever imagined they'd win a title with Brown being MVP potentially in both series over Tatum here?
I think as time went on, and this is something that we can talk about, you know, if and when they win it, I think that over the years, Tatum has had to become a much, I don't know how to say it necessarily, he's had to get so much better at everything on the floor, because there have been long stretches where Tatum was, or when Jaylen's been hurt, or when Jaylen hasn't been this all-star, all-NBA player, and Tatum definitely had to elevate all areas of his game. And we talk about Jaylen the defender this season, but Jaylen the defender this season was a product of him not playing like this on defense for, you know, the last 3 to 4 years.
So
because Jaylen came in dominating on defense, right? But I do think that as Jaylen advanced as a scorer, his defensive presence definitely waned over the years. But then this year he can do both, which is obviously great for the team, great for Celtics fans. You know, the finals MVP conversation, I think that people outside of the Celtics fandom are going to end up caring more than Celtics fans, because at the end of the day, if it's those two holding up the Larry O'Brien trophy, like, I'm certainly not going to be like, well, this one feels a little worse because Jaylen, like, I don't care. You know what I mean? Like, Tatum could go score 0 points in game 5 and they win, and I would be like just as happy as I'm going.
I actually feel the same.
40. Yeah.
Yeah.
Like,
I feel the same.
I don't care. Like, Jaylen could lay an egg in game 5 and they win, and I don't care. I mean, like, we could have a Sam Hauser game, and I've been begging in the chat for a Sam Hauser game, because if it's a Sam Hauser game, that's how I know they're up 30 points.
Yeah, you know, I'd love to talk about Hauser all night, but we only have so many minutes to gloat about the team here. And I won't be mad if Tatum wins, because a lot of times, and it will be a close vote, the last one was 4-3 Brown in these finals. I'm expecting a similar vote this time, because so many voters vote for the best player on the team that wins. That's just how it goes. I had a thought going into last game that Tatum could still win. It's heavy Brown in the odds, the betting odds. So that's kind of what I'm going off here a little bit beyond the production. But Tatum certainly, despite the poor shooting in the first two games, had massive passing nights. Two of the best passing nights we've ever seen him have, the 12 assists in game two, especially a close game two as well, where he's just getting triple teamed and there's so much pressure on him. And that's obviously leading to the other guys doing what they're doing. Drew, especially with the 26 in that game, all flowed off Tatum, drawing so many defenders on him. So that's the first thing you look at, is him improving as a passer, him becoming the initiator on this team. And that goes back to Ime, who always imagined that it would be that way when he became the coach here. And, you know, Kemba going out the door and then becoming more Jays centric than point guard centric. So big credit to him there. But if I'm writing the story, if I'm doing the documentary on this year, you mentioned Brown's defense. That to me stood out day one. And I'd call his extension day one of this season, back last July when, you know, he had his MIT conference or his MIT program that he did, and he did the presser there for the $300 million deal. And again, there was so much debate back then, Taylor. Should you do it? Should you not? Should you trade him so you don't have to do this? Does he deserve it after the meltdown he had in the playoffs? So much scrutiny for him coming out of last year. And he said that day, I want to get back to defense. I want this team to get back to defense, because my biggest problem with the team a year ago, and you know, I had a lot of them, they lost that defensive edge and they got it back in a big way this year. And I think that tone he set on day one, and Joe was basically there saying, yeah, let's do it. They needed that. They needed someone to make a statement. They needed someone to claim an identity this year that they would all rally around. And I thought the defense for pretty much the whole year was outstanding. And Porzingis' addition was a great part of that. Drew certainly allowed them to do some wacky things on that side of the ball and try a bunch of different stuff and communicate and make the calls on that end. So he deserves a ton of credit too. But Brown, as you mentioned, coming off a year where he was so bad on that end, and he had so many issues over the last couple of years, despite him looking like a guy who's capable of playing great on that side, him coming out and being a guy who shuts down the opposing best player, that set the tone for everything this year, I felt like. And he didn't make all defense. I thought he deserved a little bit of a longer look there. But regardless, he was fantastic on that side.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you remember when he was young, that's, you know, he was improving as a scorer, but he could really, really hang his hat and get on the floor by playing defense. And I just think that for a while, especially because you had Smart and then you add Derek White. And so there wasn't so much of an emphasis. But I mean, from the time that he said that he wanted to get back to defense, he backed that up with, you know, actions along the way, because we have other guys in the league who say, yeah, I want to be Derek White. And guess who didn't become Derek White?
Right? Everyone wants to. Bronny James wants to be Derek White now.
Right. And so like you have all these guys who say, oh, I really want to like ramp up the intensity on defense, and they might do it for, you know, a few game stretch here and there, but it doesn't last. I mean, and Jalen went out there for every game he played this season. You're right. I think he did deserve more of a look for all defense. And I mean, he was so impressive on that end of the ball. And even though his numbers were down, I thought he was an improved scorer as well. And him taking a bigger load on defense definitely allowed Tatum to play more of like, I wouldn't say he, because he's not really roving, you know what I mean? But definitely play defense in a different way that I think has allowed him to take much more, you know, a bigger load on offense in terms of, you know, distributing and being that, you know, initiator, like you said. So it's really worked out. And I think that this is the perfect balance between those two that we've been looking for. Are they ever going to like run pick and roll together all the time? Because 2 years ago, that's what people said. You know what I mean? JJ Redick said their skills are redundant, right? And I think they've done a good job. They absolutely are. But I think they've done a good job of seeing those gray areas that they can really focus on to maybe not limit that redundancy, but figure out how that can fit together and took it to a whole other level this year. Because, I mean, Brown benefits so much. If Tatum's drawing three people to him, that means that Jalen gets to play, you know, one-on-one or one with, you know, some help, but not the help that he should get, right? He doesn't get the coverage that he should get, the coverage that he's capable of demanding. So it works out. And as a Celtics fan, it's so rewarding to have watched these guys take different steps, you know, fall on their face a couple times, have super high highs that didn't really, you know, contribute to anything. Like, you know, we've had a couple playoff games over the years where Jalen goes and puts up 40 and they lose, right? And so those don't get remembered so much. And we have games in the regular season where it's the same thing. Or, you know, we've had games where Tatum puts up, you know, not so much in the playoffs, but like 50 points in a regular season game and they don't pull it out. 45 in a regular season game and they don't pull it out. So to see them be able to work out some of the issues, some of the flaws that plagued them for so many years this season, and especially throughout this playoff run, has been so rewarding. And that's why it ultimately doesn't matter to me, you know, who wins finals MVP. You know, like, I don't have the investment. I'm not a 15-year-old on NBA Twitter who, you know, my whole fandom is reliant on one player having success. Like, they have shown that they can lead a team to the highest level and dominate at that level.
Yeah, and that leaves Tatum in a weird place here, right? And if they win it all, I don't think anyone 10 years from now is going to say, oh, they won it all, but look at Tatum's numbers. But in the moment, it is weird to sit here and say they're rolling. They've basically smoked every team they've gone through to this point, and he hasn't played at his absolute best, which is weird because I'm not going to say he's out there intentionally shooting poorly or just absorbing all this pressure and that's the game plan, that he's not going to play well offensively, but it's going to benefit everyone else. I think to some degree, that's how they align the offense. And that's why sometimes I get a little frustrated that they don't make the game easier for him. Because, man, he does have to wear, right, the pressure that defenses throw at him, the criticism from him not shooting great, even if they win, and do all the little things, which he's received plenty of praise for this playoff as well. So, again, he could not be MVP here. He could still play a major part in this run. And he'll become a champion, which I think in many ways will affirm the milestones that he's achieved to this point. And you've talked about the points he scored before 26 and the heights he's rising up the all-time Celtics three-point mark. I think he just passed Bill Russell in playoff points. Celtics all time, which is pretty amazing, even though, you know, obviously there's the difference in games and all that that makes you understand that. He's going to exit this playoff in a weird spot, though, just because we know how it's going to get covered. We know how it's going to get talked about. But for him to finally get that championship, which is really, as he said, the only thing that he's missing to this point in terms of accomplishments, that should affirm him in a way that allows him to wear the bad shooting nights and whatever else you might be able to criticize him a little more comfortably, just because, you know, he'll have the ring, he'll have the trophy, he'll have at that point pulled off one of the five best Celtics careers ever already. So yep, this is huge for him. But to some, like, how do you feel about the fact that he just hasn't played at his best these playoffs? Because aren't those two things a little weird?
It is weird, but I think it speaks so much to his growth as a player that inefficient shooting hasn't taken him out completely to the point where he's non-existent, right? Like, because there was a time that if he wasn't shooting well, you can't necessarily rely on him to be the dynamic player, right? He's still going to be out there. He might hit a three every now and then, but he's not going to be like someone who's still demanding that attention. I think the Warriors, and I'd have to go back and watch it more, but like the Warriors seem pretty comfortable just playing Andrew Wiggins on him because he wasn't shooting well and you didn't have to focus so much on him. And I think Brian Windhorst made a good point earlier this week where he said, you know, Jason Kidd can say that Jaylen Brown's the best player on the team, but the coverages he's throwing at Tatum doesn't say that.
And isn't Tatum, it great? You know, you see them put three guys on him and you're like, great, this is amazing. That's going to help Celtics so much.
And there was a time that, you know, we wouldn't have been saying that. And I think there's two things, right? I think in the beginning of his career, there was so much. His rookie year, he kind of got, everyone loved that rookie year, right? Like, because it was awesome. He performed very well. They went to game seven of the conference finals. That second year, there was so much talk about, oh, his shot selection, it's not good. There's too many difficult mid-range shots. There's too many this, too many that. He needs to shoot more threes and get to the rim more. And then he became, I would say those middle couple years, he became like threes and layups. That was his game, right? And now we're at a point where people are like, oh, well, you know, his efficiency on those threes isn't good anymore, so why is he shooting all these threes? So it's been this weird roller coaster. But to speak to the career already, right? So it's year seven for him. You're looking at a player who was Gatorade player of the year in high school, went to Duke, you know, probably the most storied, you know, college situation in the country next to, you know, the maybe UCLA and Kansas could have a say, you know, but in terms of like contemporary history, it's Duke. Goes number three to the Boston Celtics, has the most playoff points, most playoff wins, most playoff field goals since he's come into the league, and now he's on the doorstep of winning a championship with the league's most storied franchise. So you're looking at a bunch of milestones. Plus, he's already a gold medalist, Olympic gold medalist, and there's a good chance that he goes and gets another one this summer, right? So you're looking at like high level accolades, high level performances from a player who's our age, right? He's in the same class as you and I. He's 26 years old, and he's already had like a career that, you know, a couple years ago before LeBron made everyone think it was normal to play 20 seasons, people would have been ready to hang it up, right? When guys played 10, 12 seasons, like he would have been two-thirds of the way through like a storybook career at this point. But with how things work now, I mean, he's on the front end of what most people consider, you know, what his prime years would be. So I think his evolution as a player, we might be seeing, you know, close to the final product of what Jason Tatum is. But in terms of like the heights he can reach in terms of greatness, I think like we're just scratching the surface. And I'm so excited and so like thankful that it's happening with these two guys doing it together, right? And I didn't know. I knew that Jalen and Jason knew each other before the league. And there's that famous picture of them from 2014. But like, I didn't know that they were roommates at like multiple camps, and they kept getting put together in these random spots. And that Danny Ainge called Jaylen Brown and was like, "Hey, what do you think about Tatum?" Like, I didn't know all that. So that makes me feel even more so like this was written, like it's supposed to happen this way. And you know, the whole dynasty talk seems pretty worthless to me at this point. Like, let's win game five before we start, you know, speculating whether the Celtics team is going to become a dynasty. But I do think for Tatum individually, it's been a pretty storybook beginning to his career so far. And a championship, I think, only solidifies a lot of the things. Like, you're still going to have the people who say, oh, his percentages weren't very good in the finals. But like, when they talk about the great players, no one talks about percentages, right? No one talks like you said, 10 years from now, like, yeah, will the sickos be like, let's look at the basketball reference page? Sure. But when people are just talking about it, they're not going to be like, well, he shot 29% from three in that series, so does it really count? Like, no one's going to say that.
Yeah. And you look at some of the performances, the 61 combined in game three, the comeback at Indiana down 18. You definitely have those moments there on this run that are going to be fun to look back on for both of them. And certainly Brown's been a leader in many senses there in terms of what he's done. So you go back to 2022, which until very recently was still the team that I really loved among all these teams the most, because they got to that doorstep. They did it with an identity, I felt like, and they came up short in a big way at the finals. But you felt like you were starting to build something with that group, and they had to reshape it on the fly. Obviously, they made all these different moves, Rob, Brogdon, all these guys come and go, Grant, and you get the right mix here with Drew and Kristaps was incredibly important. Still kind of weird that they're going to do this with only a couple games of Kristaps, but he certainly had his moment in game one of this series in a major way, which, again, talk about moments, him coming out and hitting all those shots after missing 5 weeks is going to go down as a real one there. And I know they want to probably run him out for the final minutes or whatever they have planned there with making him active, but feels like his run's done here as far as actually impacting things. So it's another layer to this where you give Brown and Tatum a lot of credit for being able to sustain that. You give Al a ton of credit to do what he's doing at 38, which continues to be what impresses me as much as anything here. Just out of this world, the way he's able to defend on switches and get out on the perimeter and hit shots. He just carries such heavy weight for a guy that age, for a guy who's been through as many miles and runs as he has. It's unbelievable that you still rely on him to the degree that you do, because you have no one else. Tillman can play a couple minutes, Cornette's effective in spots, but it's all on Al at center, and he carries that weight at 38. It's unreal. And then you get to Joe, who I've criticized, who I didn't think did a great job in year one, but I understand why he didn't. And then through the course of this year, built an identity for himself, hit the right buttons, gained the belief of this team in a substantial way. I don't think he totally had the belief of the team last year. And then as this year went on, he gained it in a major way to where these guys love him, it feels like, and truly believe in every little word he says. They pay attention to all the little details he mentions. And he's, I think, the driver of their consistency this year, almost going 80-20, never losing more than two games. Him just being so prepared on the ball, making the adjustments when they need him, having all the options to go to. And they've made a million different adjustments in terms of their game plans and how they've played teams in these series, and defense and offense. And I think his offensive philosophy from day one, as much as you can get frustrated by all the threes and think that they get a little stagnant and play too much isolation, it got rid of their turnovers. Like 2 years ago, you turned the ball over 100 times with Tatum alone, and that's basically what ruined you in those finals against the Warriors. Those are gone. They never turn the ball over anymore. They grab key offensive rebounds, which I think was one of the biggest differences with this team this year, that he was a driver of. They always win that free throw battle. They always win all the little things, shot margin, something I never even thought about with this team watching them before this year. They're always shooting more shots than the other team. The pace. I mean, the guy's just obsessive with basketball, and you know he's a great basketball mind, but I think what he did better this year is be a little bit more flexible, post-ups and all the rest, and add in that mentality component. And as crazy as it sounds sometimes, and as wacky as he can seemingly be, the guys hear it and they see it and they watch it play out and they start to believe in it. And whether it's the UFC stuff he's talking about or the whale, I still don't know what that's all about, everything. He has pushed all the right buttons for this team. It's clear he's the right guy for this team. I don't always love how he doesn't criticize them more than he does, but it's clear that they have those conversations internally, and he gains from defending them publicly. So I'm all for Joe at this point. It's hard not to be. And he went from being a guy who maybe would be a little bit of a weakness on this run, and maybe they win in spite of him, to being a guy who's been a huge strength and a reason that they're going to wrap this up in as few games as they have.
Yeah, I think the most important thing you said, and I think the most important thing in general, is that the players have bought into what he has to say and his methods and his, you know, what looks like weirdness from the outside. Like, I mean, you have Jason Tatum, who's, you know, arguably the most polished superstar in the NBA, right? Like, we don't really see anything about his life off the court except for him being a dad. Like, you know what I mean? Like, he has all these like elite high level sponsorships. Like, if there is anyone who'd be like, what are we doing here? Right? Like, what are we doing? It would be him, Jaylen Brown, who is a guy who's, you know, reportedly, you know, butted heads with other strong personalities before. Seems completely bought in. You have, you know, in I just think it's important that he has those two guys and to buy in. And then as Jaylen has said multiple times, like, they set the tone for the rest of the team. So if Joe can break through to them, like, everyone else will fall in line. I think it's important that Drew Holiday seems to be, you know, on board with
Drew.
Board
with
Joe. I mean, they're almost the same age, right? And Drew's like a pro's pro. He's, you know, he's got a decade of the rest of the league singing his praises and saying, you know, he might not get praised enough. Drew seems to like him. Like, Al's older than him. Al's a vet, right? Al is like a veteran. And he seems bought in. Your role guy seems bought in. And so I think that's so important, because last year there were obviously questions, like something as simple as like the timeouts, right? The timeouts were driving all of us insane last year. I guess I should say the lack thereof. And now, you know, we go from 1 year, there's not enough timeouts to the next year. It's like, oh, are they going to foul up six with 20 seconds left? Because, you know, that's how far ahead you have to be. So we went from being like, this guy might not know how, like, be able to feel when
they steal every little advantage, Taylor.
Yes.
Every, like, right. If he can gain this much of an advantage, they're highlighting it and they're taking it. And it almost, you don't want to make the Belichick comparison because it's a little early, and it's the greatest, you know, one of the greatest coaches ever in football history versus a guy in year two of his NBA career. But you look at the winning percentage so far, And that's not just because he has all the talent. It's a big reason why his winning percentage is what it is. But he just steals every tiny advantage. And in some ways, that's Belichick-esque.
Well, and I think the biggest thing that I see is their willingness to win different ways, right? And I think last year it was a big, if they don't hit threes, they're not going to win this game, right? If they don't hit threes, they're not going to win the game.
They just won a finals game shooting 25% from three.
Exactly. Right. So I think that this motto that they have that says, you know, it's whatever it takes, however long it takes, was like the backbone of the Patriots dynasty, right? Like, you know, the biggest example is the Pats went into Indianapolis in like 2015 and Jonas Gray had 200 yards and four touchdowns and Tom Brady barely threw the ball because that's what that game called for, right? You have the greatest quarterback of all time and you can go, you know, say, all right, go light it up, throw it 35, 40 times and we'll live with that, right? They could say, hey, JT, you take 25 shots, Jalen, you take 23 shots and that's what we live with every single night, right? And the numbers do end up being with those two taking the most shots, you know, night in, night out, as they should. But I think it speaks a lot to Missoula and a lot to the team in general that someone like Tatum in games one and two, despite the criticism, is willing to just go in the paint and kick it out, right? Over and over and over again and not get bored with it, not get insecure and say, hey, like, oh, you know, if I don't get 30 this game, they're going to be talking about me again tonight and they're going to have, you know, 3 days to talk about me. And I think that speaks more to Missoula than anything, is that he's willing to win the game however they need to win the game. He's not in a system that's so rigid that says, hey, like, this is how we're going to do it. And if it doesn't work, then, you know, you throw your hands up and say it doesn't work. And then the players buying into that, which is important in general, but also them being willing to put their pride, their individual pride, to the side every now and then to say, hey, like, you know, if I need to go get 12 assists, but only score, what was it, 16 points in game one for Tatum? If I need to go score 16, but I'm going to dish the ball 12 times, I'm going to guard the other team center, like, that is what it is. I think that's the mark of a champion. I think that's the reason they're in the position they're in, right? That's why they're up 3-1 in the NBA Finals, is because from their best player, from number one to number 15, every single guy is willing to do what they need to make sure that this team accomplishes what they're supposed to. And I think that it starts at the top with Missoula. You know, it might start a little bit above them with Wick and the ownership group and them being willing to go above and beyond and make sure the team has everything they need to win a championship. But on the court, you have a coach who's willing to do anything, and that's certainly translating to the players.
Yeah, you mentioned Brad. I wasn't even going to go there, but we sat there in 2021 and said, what the hell are they doing? Moving him to GM. Ainge goes out the door. Who deserves some credit here? He built the core. Certainly. He drafted Brown and Tatum, and I think that set the tone for what they're doing now. But Brad had the different ideas and the extra level of aggressiveness to get them where they need to go. White, you had the foresight to go get Brogdon, and that became Holiday, and you snuck that in before some of the rules changed that would have prevented trades like that. I wrote about that last night. You couldn't do the Brogdon trade the way it was done under the current rules because they banned throwing all those minimum contracts together to match the money. You, as a second apron team before the full rules actually started this year, couldn't combine contracts to trade for one guy. So you couldn't do Rob and Brogdon for Holiday if it was this summer. So they got all that done before this. And so now, you know, I know Embiid was talking last night, oh, this isn't going to be a dynasty because they're going to get split up between the second apron and tax and all that. And the tax might still come into play here. But they've made all their moves. These guys are all still relatively in their prime. They're cohesive. You won without Porzingis this year. You went 12-0, Taylor, when Brown wasn't in the lineup, which is pretty amazing. You won games without Tatum this year. You could pretty much win without anyone in this lineup except Derek White, who I'm still hoping they can figure out something with here because he's about as important as anyone and unsung as anyone to me in this whole dynamic. He was really the guy, the addition that got the ball rolling on them becoming elite. So I hope that gets done. But Brad made all this happen. You give credit to other guys in that front office too, who are holdovers from Ainge. But Brad, man, we came up and we knew him as this coach who was so transformative. And you know, you started to have those debates in the later years, like, do you fire him? Is he losing his touch here? And the GM thing just seemed like a way to waste out his contract and not have to pay him to go away. And he would go coach somewhere else before long. And that would just be sort of a shambolic way to usher him out of the organization. And now he's going from, yeah, he was one of the better coaches in the NBA, to his legacy becoming one of the best GMs ever, at least over the first couple of years, which is crazy to think about given how we looked at him over the start of his career.
It is crazy because, you know, like he was like kind of like the, I mean, he was a young coach who brought Butler to two national championship games, right?
Yeah,
he
was
like
go back even further.
He was a new young guy, right? And he was gonna come in and kind of pick up the pieces to like a great Celtics team that effectively had fallen apart, right? Like, and that's what he was gonna be. I don't know if I ever saw this level from him, but I always did have a feeling that because of his experience at coach, and we saw the teams that he was dealing with, right? They had glaring holes and glaring issues that Danny Ainge was never willing to part with some assets to fill, right? Like, how many years did you and I have to sit through, whether it's free agency or the trade deadline, where it's like the Celtics are very interested in this player, right? And it's like, all right, we get it. Like, they're linked to every single superstar, but it never happens, and it is what it is, right? And I was fine
with
it.
And they were letting guys go for nothing. Horford, right. Irving, Rozier. Yeah.
And it's just like, you know, he's rolling with the punches. But I think Brad always knew what he had with the core of the team and could also see what the team needed. But as the coach, you don't make those decisions, right? Like, you might have a little input, but you're not the one pulling the trigger saying, hey, like, you know, like, especially this summer where it's like, is Marcus Smart the heart and soul of the team? Yes. But he's a very volatile player, right? He's up and he's down. And then you move him for a big who can stretch the floor, which is what you needed, because despite how much we all love Rob, he just wasn't looking to score on offense. And in 2024, that doesn't necessarily fly. And then you have this hole, right? This gap in the team. And you're looking around. It's like, all right, we need a guard who can play defense, who can, you know, initiate offense sometimes, but really it's like play defense and hit threes. And it's like, who do they end up with? And granted, it was a stroke of luck that Drew Holiday Definitely. Became available, right? But like, I don't know if Danny Ainge makes the trade to bring in Drew Holiday. I don't know if he, you know, takes someone that he acquired the summer before and packages him with, you know, a fan favorite and says, all right, and two firsts and says, all right, you know what I mean? We're going for it. So
he certainly wouldn't have done White.
Right. And I think Brad always saw what the team needed. And then fortunately for the team, they put him in a position that he could address those needs. And, you know, obviously for half a season and one playoff run, it looked like they had their coach of the future, and then that fell apart. Right. And then Brad had the wherewithal and he had the guts to go with this unknown guy, this unknown, like relatively strange guy, to become the head coach of the Boston Celtics with 4 days notice. And now
you're main Red Claws assistant. Yeah. Right. Who was probably like fifth in the hierarchy on their bench.
Yeah, right. And so it's like, there's a lot to be said. And like Brad wasn't executive of the year for no reason. Like, he's not that just because they had the best record in the league. Like, I don't know if there's a single decision that he's made to this point that I look at and I'm like, man, I really, really don't like that. Even something like think about last year, right? You're what? Last year, your fourth string point guard comes to you and is like, I'm not playing enough, please trade me, right? I think most GMs are like, all right, man, like, we'll figure out something for you. You know what I mean? Right. Like, we'll figure out something for you. And he was like, no, I'm definitely not trading you. In fact, I'm going to give you a new contract, so you're going to stay around even longer because we see the vision for you. And it's not just like, yeah, you're not playing right now, we'll get rid of you. You know what I mean? Like, I think little moves like that are important. And man, it's been awesome to watch. I love watching him coach. I love even more like the moves that he makes now in the confidence that he has in his core, in Jalen and Jason, to build around them.
Yeah, and I'll rattle off a lot of honorable mentions here because there's a million. You mentioned one in Pritchard, who was out the door. All the reporting was that they had a trade lined up, Gallinari, Pritchard for Jakob Poeltl. And, you know, you talk about like the Justice Winslows of the world and all those what if that did happen, that would have been pretty bad. And that one's an underrated one, looking back on it, because you would have lost Pritchard. Pritchard probably goes to San Antonio and scores 20, 25 points a game. And Pirlo just probably wouldn't have been a fit here and probably would have blocked the Porzingis thing from happening and all that down the line. But they had a vision for Pritchard, certainly. And I remember Brad over the summer saying, you know, part of the reason for moving out of Brogdon in that deal and part of the reason they felt good about that is because Pritchard was ready and they felt good about him. It just, he didn't have minutes. And certainly when you look at last year, it was Smart and Brogdon playing and it was White and Pritchard sitting more often than not. And those two stepped up and became a major part of this year's team. Pritchard with that half court shot in game two, another moment you're going to remember from this run, the defense he's played all year. He's been Brogdon in many ways, not six man of the year level play, but for what they need at that role, which is effectively the third guard on the team, he's brought a lot to that position. And now he's on a value 4-year contract and is probably going to play out most of his days here in Boston, which is crazy to think about when you consider where he was a year ago. Hauser, two-way guy 2 years ago who basically stood there in his clothes during that finals, playing real minutes and giving them something here in these NBA finals while guarding Luka, never on my list. No. You go down the line here, Luke Kornet. They traded Tice for him in 2021. He was basically just a throw-in. He drove his Toyota Camry to Chicago to meet them, or I think it was Milwaukee to meet them. Probably could have been cut. Instead, he played a couple of good games and won that spot over Mo Wagner. The next year, he doesn't get a contract, so he goes to play for the Bucks on a COVID deal, goes to play for the Cavs on a COVID deal, and then ends up back here, basically chilling in Maine for a year or so, and then becomes a depth center on this team and actually ends up becoming really good this year in that role. So his winding path to where he ended up here as a potential champion has been pretty crazy. Sam Cassell, an 08 champion, coming in here after Doc got fired and being a pretty good assistant. He could win his second championship here with the Celtics as a coach this time, which is pretty cool. O'Shea Brissett, who we went to Syracuse with, who we covered and watched at Syracuse, signing a late summer contract with them and probably looking like a guy who's just going to sit around on the bench, but actually carving out like this nice energy offensive rebounding role here and becoming a champion on, you know, our hometown team. Story.
He's kind of like a fan favorite too. Like fans really, I mean, I think Brissy Files has something to do with the vlog, but like I have Celtics fans, you know, my people from Western Mass that I'm, you know, where I grew up with. And they're like, hey, we need Brissett minutes in the finals. You know what I mean? Like they're calling for O'Shea Brissett to get in the game in the finals because they think he can provide something.
Yeah, unbelievable. And I wasn't sure how that was going to go because he definitely has some weaknesses in his game where if he had to play a lot more, probably would have led to some frustration. But he found a perfect role here to where he basically exclusively focused on rebounding and defending. And that worked well for him. And he certainly has gotten comfortable here in a way that is great to see too. And he's probably going to be back. You know, he's got another year on his deal.
It seems like the guys really like him too.
Yeah. Tillman wasn't the smoothest transition, but Porzingis goes down and he has a really good game off the bench, hits that corner three, another moment after shooting 24% all year from there in that game two. So he gets some credit here too. The bench was really good this year and you weren't sure how that was going to go when they basically traded depth for the top six, the powerful top six there. But all these guys even go deep, deep, deep on the bench. Shfi Mihailuk didn't play much this year, but when he did, he was solid. And Nemeyish Keita, a two-way guy. And you've been saying for years, oh, man, look at the Heat. They get all these guys from out of nowhere, and they just become great players. Why can't the Celtics do that? Keita was playing a pretty good couple weeks of basketball when they were really injured at center.
Yeah, he was awesome for a while this season. Like I was loving. Like, what was the game where they had the jump ball and I can't remember what game it was. There was a jump ball that kind of got like batted around and then he grabbed it and just like two-hand dunk and like tried to rip the rim out of the backboard. Like Keita had moments this season. I think he endeared himself to fans too.
Yeah, and so not only did the pro team go to the finals this year, the G League team did, and it wasn't just some fluky thing. They actually started, you know, you mentioned Joe and how they've invested in him and you know, they go to him as the coach in a pinch, but they clearly saw something in him that they were developing behind the scenes and on the bench and stuff like that, behind what they were actually doing at head coach. Behind this championship level team you have here, you got Kata developing, and they draft Jordan Walsh, and he had this really good year in Maine. And it's just, you know, they go and get Springer, who looks like he could maybe become a little something. So while the top end, the older half of the team, is winning a championship, you have this lower half of the team that could actually do something maybe over the next couple of years here, fill in for some guys who could go out the door. So, you know, that I think that credit goes to Brad too, how they just have a very functional organization at this point, and one that really is in a good place. And to wrap up this conversation, because I know a lot of people are talking about this, the fact that it's where it is now, looking back at where it was in 2021, where it was just an absolute mess. And we were having real discussions daily, Taylor, about where this franchise was going. It was ugly. It was really ugly.
We were together for that Nets series. We were down in Texas. And I remember we were on the plane flying back to Massachusetts for game five that they lost and the season was over. And I remember being like, I don't know what's going to happen from here, right? Like they made the conference finals in the bubble. They made it in 2018 and it felt great. And it was like, man, are Tatum and Brown or just Tatum? If you trade Brown, is it just going to be a situation where it's like, yeah, it was fun in the beginning. And then you have this like middle period. Pretty much it felt like, is Tatum's career and is the team's trajectory going to mirror Paul Pierce, right? Where it's like good in the beginning and then it's miserable in that middle section until the guy's like in his 30s and then you finally put it back together, right? And then, I mean, it was less than a year and they were in the finals from that point. So it's been unbelievable. And I think people always look back to like the like Marshawn Brooks era, you know what I mean? Like the post KG Paul Pierce trade. And I think during COVID, it can get easily glossed over what the team looked like then. And, you know, recently there's been a lot more like the bloopers coming out of those seasons where it was like really crazy, 2020 and 2021. But like,
we loved it.
Watching it night in and night out, that season with no fans, was really like, huh, like this could be bad, right? Like this could be bad for a little while unless things really turn around. And credit to Brad Stevens, they bumped. I mean, shit, the guy got essentially removed from the coaching position because of how things were going, right? It wasn't all on him, but like you said, when he went to GM, I was excited to keep him around because like I have a lot of respect for Brad as a basketball mind and a figure within the organization, but I was like, this seems like kind of like a gentle way to keep things moving forward. And then from that moment on, they have been, you know, one of, if not the best team in the NBA, you know, they're at least competing for it the whole time since.
Yeah. And that reminds me too, Jeff Van Gundy is going to be here for a championship, which I know a lot of New York fans are mad about. He was on the staff too this year. So up and down, you can just name a lot of really cool things about this team. The 08 team, Pierce especially, was pretty close to this group early, especially you had Rondo around at the beginning too, and KG has been closer at different points here. So that was another layer this year that was pretty cool. But it was a really cool year all around. A lot less drama-filled than you would have anticipated just based on how recent years were going. But that was a nice change of pace after just how chaotic the last 3 years before this were. They just took care of business this year, and they still have to do it. You know, let's see how scary this season gets. There's still shades of the old Celtics that always pop out. And again, it'd be very fitting if they went out and made this a lot harder on themselves than it needs to be here. But it looks like they're going to win a championship here, and it's going to be really special when it happens, especially if it happens at Boston on Tuesday.
You know
what
was a great sign this year, Bob?
What?
When they beat the Warriors by 52 points on Tatum's birthday.
Yeah.
Because we know, man, the Tatum birthday thing, I didn't think it was real. But, man, the year before when they gave up that 30-point lead to Brooklyn, I was like, how does a player's birthday? Obviously, that's not the reason they lost. But it was definitely like, like they were getting ready to go out and they gave up a 30-point lead to the Brooklyn Nets, who really weren't that good. And then this year they came out and put 52 point win on the Warriors.
Yes, and what a weekend, because you get the Celtics on the verge of a championship, and you also get this record, which I've been waiting a long time for. 8 years later, Anderson .Paak, knowledge, release, no, why Lord, has no worries. And it lived up to the hype. So you and Nate, you reviewed it over on the Cap, and people can go check that out. I'll put the link in the bio. But I had to hop on here since I wasn't included in that show and give my thoughts and talk about it with you, because this is special, man. These are two of my – this is probably my favorite producer and my favorite artist. Their group, their pairing, vaulted Anderson .Paak into the stardom he's in now. And for him to go back and really put in the work on a record with that guy who's transformative to the early portion of his career and do something this magical. And I really love this album. You know, I'm still kind of absorbing it, obviously, here. But it lived up to the hype. It was worth the wait. You mentioned it, the grownness of the album and just how mature the topics are and how emotional but fleshed out and true to Anderson .Paak's personality and style it is. Those all just made it a completely different experience than Yes Lord, which was obviously an album that came out very early in our time at Syracuse. It was sort of a surprise album in many ways because he had just put out Malibu Solo, which was amazing. And then that comes out almost as a bonus. And it's like, okay, this isn't Malibu, but this is a different style. This is a different character that he's almost putting on in this music here. And it follows like this great tradition of a lot of rappers slash, you know, hip hop artists who would almost put on a caricature of themselves. You know, MF Doom, obviously the most famous example here. And this is obviously the label that put out Mad Villainy. So for him to have this character, because, you know, I think it is a little bit of a dramatization of Anderson .Paak. Like, I think Anderson .Paak's music is Anderson .Paak, and this is almost like a, you know, very like womanizing slash you know, partying character who, you know, sort of gets down in the dumps about the issues that gives him with his woman in turn. And knowledge just creates this backing, this world for him in this music that really takes you to another place. The production's like nothing I've really ever heard in this era. And Anderson .Paak, man, he can just do it all. Like, yeah, this is great. And I love knowledge. I love everything he does. I've really become more interested in his solo work since Yes Lord came out. So I've sort of been following him as much as I have Anderson .Paak. And he's sort of obviously the guy who's like the voice of the group since Pack's doing so many different stuff. But, you know, there was a point where I just never thought this was going to come out. And I love the rollout. I love the vinyl here. I love how they put it out on physical a week before the streaming, which came out, which we can get into a little bit here too. But man, this is amazing.
Yeah, man. Well, it's, you know, I've said, you know, what I need to say about the music, but makes me think of two things. So naturally, like, you and I went to college together, big Celtics fans, and people would think that that was like what made us friends, and it's what made us meet each other, right? But what really had us actually talking to each other for the first time was Anderson .Paak. I saw you tweeting about him, and I hadn't really listened to him, and I DM'd you, and I was like, hey, should I like look into this? And you were like, yeah, definitely, like, he's one of my favorites. And then I talked to you about it. So like, people don't know that Anderson .Paak, more so than the Celtics or the Red Sox or Q's or anything, was why me and you ended up going from like, yeah, we saw each other around, but to being like, oh, we actually like go back and forth about something. So that's one thing. And then speaking of Stone's Throw Records, I'll always, you know, mention this. I'll always bring this up. I have a Stone's Throw vinyl in my collection from you. You bought me you bought me donuts out here.
Donuts and knowledge, obviously a Jay Dilla guy. There's a lot of parallels there, and I think, you know, he's more Madlib in many ways than Dilla, but, you know, he was someone who studied Dilla, and I think in many ways is like a modern Jay Dilla in terms of how eclectic some of his stuff is here. And, you know, this isn't music everybody's gonna love, but when you listen to it, it will hit you and say, wow, this is something a little different. This is something that is really good.
I think it's music that not everyone would even give a chance because they don't necessarily know, or they may have heard of Anderson .Paak, probably haven't heard of Knowledge, and they won't play it. But I do feel like this is an album where it's like, you know, in my opinion, like 8 out of 10 people, you put this on, listen to the whole thing through, like at the very least, you're going to get some like laughs out of it, right? Like you're going to get like this, like, man, it plays almost more like a movie than it does an album, which is a great compliment. You know, I think that's what, you know, my favorite albums, you know, play like that. And yeah, I think you're right. I think it's great. I'm glad it finally came out. Cause I also was at a point where I was like, I don't know if this is going to happen, especially when it seemed like Anderson .Paak's star was just going to get, you know, way too big.
That's what I love, man. He's a superstar.
World. Yeah.
I mean, he did the Super Bowl and here he is with the guy he started with. And again, I don't think people realize this, and you guys got into a lot of like the divorce aspect of this album, which is an interesting place he's at in his life right now with the stardom and all the fame he's achieved. And I'm sure some of his love life that's probably gone to a different place, but he met his wife when they were poor, when they really didn't have any prospects in music at that point. And, you know, a very talented guy, a guy who drummed for, you know, American Idol and stuff like that, like obviously had the chops and worked with some big people early on that probably could have led him to, I don't know, be like a drummer in a band or like on a show or something like that. Just sort of have a successful career for a musician, but not become a star. And especially the way he's done it, where, you know, there's a lot of jazz elements there. There's a lot of musicianship, which in the hip hop world, you know, is a thing, but isn't kind of the thing that vaults you to superstardom. You know, he was an unlikely star. Like, I remember listening to some of the guys he worked with back in like 2012, and some of those guys, like Dumbfounded or Wax or some of these guys from LA, would have struck me as guys who would have made it big more than he would have. But you know, that's back when he was doing his work with Knowledge, you know, who he met back then, who did like a remix of one of his songs, and that's sort of what Knowledge was doing to get on. And, you know, Knowledge in his own right had a production credit on To Pimp a Butterfly, which is sort of like his superstardom moment. But these are two guys who really took untraditional paths to become really big superstars. And this album, and, you know, my mind is kind of like a victory lap. Like, they're working with Earl Sweatshirt here. They're working with Dave Chappelle. They're working with her, who's a superstar who did the Super Bowl. There's some real big production credits here. And, you know, like Nate said, this album's not going to go number one. But this is a big album from a low-key, underground kind of collective who's making like very eclectic hip-hop here / R&B. So, I mean, this is really cool here, man, because, you know, us, we're big hip-hop guys. We're into some of the underground acts. We're into some of the guys who are really good, who maybe deserve the credit that some of the big, big stars do, but don't get it because it's, you know, it's not pop music. To see someone who's doing all that get that kind of superstar status, and both of them have in some ways between Knowledge and Anderson .Paak, to me is just so gratifying. That's why I was so excited for this album, because I just love seeing everything they're doing. And like I said, I've been following Knowledge's career a lot. I got to see them live last year, last summer. The fact that .Paak is still dedicating himself to this project, to this guy that he worked with early on, to me is really cool.
Yeah. No, it definitely is. And I think, you know, there's a lot of times where we wish artists would do that, right? And it does happen, you know what I mean? Like Earl coming back to do an album with Alchemist, and I think Alchemist is a great example, like, because we've had so many, but even someone like, it's a little different because, you know, someone like Metro Boomin is on he's on a superstar level himself, but Future, you know what I mean? Like coming back and recreating some magic with Metro and doing a full project with him. I mean, I gravitate towards albums that are fully produced by one person more so than, you know, your albums that are all over the place. Anyways, but I think it's cool. Like, I think, like you said, the guy was doing the Super Bowl with some of the biggest legends in hip hop history. And here he is almost a decade after Yes Lord coming back and, you know, kind of following through, which is something that a lot of artists don't do. And they just say, hey, you know what I mean? Like, they'll always be tongue in cheek about it. They're like, you never know, man. Like, that one's in the vault. Like, someday it'll come out. And then it just never does. Right. And you just give up on it. 8 years is a long time between albums, but a lot has happened in those 8 years. And it's not like we haven't gotten music from either of them in that time. It's not like they just both disappeared. Right. But I do think them coming back together to give us a full project, that's a very like intimate project about, you know, a difficult time in real life. It's not like a, all right, we're, you know, we're both at like a higher place now. We're coming back to like flex. It's right. No, it's like, no, like real life happened again. And so you go back to like your, you know, your real life, what works best in real life. So I have a lot of appreciation for it. I'm glad it came out. I'm glad that we got to review it. We went early on Saturday morning. So I know you were probably, you know, you just worked the night before. So.
Yeah, no, I enjoyed that review. And again, I'll link to it below. The only other thing that you guys didn't get into that I do want to emphasize here, and obviously I have two vinyls in my hand, a very creative thing in this music climate where everyone wants the music right away, where everyone tears through it because it comes out on streaming and they can just press the button and play it at midnight and maybe never listen to it again. You had to wait 8 years for this if you wanted to hear it. And obviously some singles came out and there was a music video recently with Snoop Dogg and all that. So you were teased. And they played some of that on their last tour last summer. So it wasn't like they had nothing. And then this just popped out. But when this got announced, they said, if you buy the physical, if you buy the vinyl, you're going to get it a week early. And so I order it and I'm expecting to get it right when I come back from India, I think it was, or something like that, wherever I was. And the mail, it didn't come through. You know, I'm checking the mail every couple minutes. Then I finally go on my computer and I'm like, man, what's going on? And then it said it wasn't coming until the following Thursday, the day before it was going to come out on streaming. So I'm like, what the hell? So I'm running around to stores. You know, I go to one vinyl store, they don't have it. I go to the next one and I'm looking around. I don't see it. I'm like, they're not going to have it on release day. That's not even like a thing anymore. So I'm walking out and I see it on like the front vinyl stack. And I'm like, yeah. So there was a whole hunt for this album that was like, I don't know, when would you do that, Taylor? Like 2004? Like people haven't gone and searched for albums in stores in like 10, 20 years. And here I am in 2024 running around looking for an album that came out that day, throwing it on the vinyl.
As you know, vinyl is
an album that no one else can listen to.
That's the cool part to me, is that there's incentive to go look for it. Right, beyond just having a collector's item, beyond being able to say that you contributed, you know, so a little bit of money instead of, you know, paying $10 a month for Apple or whatever. Like, I think that's cool that it's more than just a collector's item and more than like just merch. Cause I think a lot of the times people look at vinyl now like merch, and it's not, right? It's a physical album. So I think it's cool that there was incentive for you to say, hey, I want to hear this a week early, right? So you go find it. So like I think that's really cool.
What song's going to stick with you the most off here, you feel like?
Here, let me look at the track list again. Walk on by with Earl is probably the one that will stick with me the most. But I really like She Used, however you want to say it, right? That I really like that. But honestly, like this album, like I said in the review that Nate and I did, this one's definitely going to be like and this is how I am with most albums anyways, but I just press play on the first song and I know I'm going to be, you know, locked in for 44 minutes. Like, could I listen to one song and, you know, run it back? Yeah. But for an album like this, especially because how the tracks are put together and how they flow into each other, this is more of an album for me as opposed to something that I'm going to be pulling songs from.
Yeah. And man, some of these singles are old and they still stand up, man. Where I Go is 2 years old.
I know.
Which is crazy to think about. And it's still a jam.
Yeah.
So, man, I'm so happy that we have this. I'm so happy that I can keep... It sounds really good on vinyl, too, for whatever reason. You know, that's all its own thing. But, man, I don't know what else to say about this. Obviously, it's going to be something I keep listening to. Obviously, it's going to be something I hope we can listen to and... tours and everything else. You're a big production guy, so the last question I got for you, what stands out about Knowledge's production? Because it's different.
It is different. I think that's the most important part, is it's unique. He uses unique drum patterns. He's not afraid to break out of what's correct, right? Like what's technically correct or what feels correct. He's not afraid of that. And then, I mean, you just have a variety of sounds on this album. Like There's some, like, you know, pretty classic hip hop production on it. There's stuff that's closer to, you know, the lane that those two are in, kind of like that that like groovier, jazzier production. But then he also has like,
you have like a rock anthem on here and Daydream.
Yeah, and then he right, and then he has like some like 80s like synth pop on it as well, right? So how he's putting it all together, I'd like to see, you know, more breakdowns of that. It's hit or miss with that with a lot of producers, but I think his willingness to do different things is what sets him apart, because you have so many producers out there who just find their lane and they stay there. And I think that Knowledge's lane is his own. And I think that he does such a great job of putting his signature on the music that he creates. And especially, I think it's so impressive. And I put it this way to Nate, he like rolls out this red carpet, right, for Anderson .Paak to perfectly address like what I have to assume is one of the most difficult times in Anderson .Paak's life. And it's just seamless, right? Like the way that he sets the scene for .Paak to really do what he's supposed to and do what he needs to in all these songs. That's what's impressive to me.
All right. And that's our show for today. What a month. Celtics could win a championship and No Worries finally releases a new album. So was excited to hit on all that here with Taylor. We'll be back to discuss potentially a championship here, or maybe some scary games that we didn't imagine seeing in this series when the Celtics went up 3-0. But game 5 is Tuesday. Celtics are pretty substantial favorites. And man, Taylor, Boston's going to be rocking on Monday.
Well, hey, you know what could also be true by Monday? The Red Sox might be 2 games above 500.
We'll talk about that in August. All right, Taylor, subscribe, Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, all the rest, Dome Theory, CLNS Media, Celtics All Access, and The Cap for that full No Worries breakdown. If you want to hear more from Taylor and Nate, who did not want to be here to discuss the Celtics, understandably, nor did any of our group chat co-hosts here. So we'll have to press them on that when they start talking about Bronny James and Lakers coaches and everything else that they're going to want to talk about more once the Celtics raise that banner. So I'll talk to you soon again, Taylor.
All right, see ya.